CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Christine Payne will be giving us an update on CFPDP.
So, what's the latest with the foundation?
Well, there's lots of exciting things going on at the Canadian Foundation for Physically Disabled Persons. We talked in our last interview about the upcoming Canadian Disability Hall of Fame induction luncheon. But beyond that, looking towards the end of October, we have our next selection board meeting of the Seat at the Table group. Canadians with disabilities absolutely can make a great impact on corporate boards, and this is something that CFPDP is working to do, helping businesses to find qualified candidates to place on their boards of directors.
So, in that case, what are some of the barriers in terms of board placement? I mean, why is it a priority matter having someone with a disability weighing in on corporate matters for businesses?
I think it's important to have diverse voices on boards of directors. And traditionally, a lot of companies have looked to the same, I guess you could call them talent pools, to recruit people to boards of directors. So if you look back, for example, a number of years, there was a time when there were not a lot of women represented on boards of directors. That has since changed, and so we're starting to see more women represented in corporate boardrooms. But when CFPDP started looking at this several years ago, at that time, our founder, Honorable Vim Kochar, could not identify a single person with a disability on a corporate board. So we set out to help change that. And as of now, you know, certainly we are seeing, you know, some change thanks to the work that we've been doing, the public awareness, the, you know, several hundred highly qualified people with disabilities who have applied for corporate positions through CFPDP, and thanks to our esteemed selection board that is comprised of top CEOs and executives from Bay Street, charitable and media organizations, and the chancellors of two of Canada's most prestigious universities.
So, how is the community responding to all this, the idea of including people with disabilities as part of the equation, both in business and just in the greater scheme of things?
Well, I think, you know, Canada is a diverse country. People with disabilities are the largest minority group, representing approximately 22% of our population. So it's very important to have those voices represented. And I think the general public, you know, which is comprised of people with disabilities and people without disabilities, really wants to see that change. So we're getting an enthusiastic response, from our public awareness outreach regarding this program and regarding all of our public awareness about the important roles that people with disabilities do play, both as business leaders, not necessarily always on a corporate board of directors, but, people do start their careers somewhere. And, that's one of the reasons that CFPDP has set up and is working to set up endowment funds to help fund bursaries and scholarships to help people with disabilities, students with disabilities, to get post-secondary education, because that can help prepare them for senior positions, including one day, potentially, a seat at a corporate board table.
So, in that sense, for some of these business leaders, there's always the possibility, as most of us will acquire some sort of disability in our lifetime. So, preparing policies and just equal opportunities, it's kind of preparing for their own future in a sense, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, the point you raised that any of us, could become disabled at some point in our life is absolutely true. Not everybody who has a disability is born with a disability. Disabilities, can be acquired later in life. So it is certainly something that we all need to be aware of. And we need to support all members of our population. You know, going back to the endowment funds, for example, financial hardship can be one of the reasons that students with disabilities may not acquire professional designations. So that's why CFPDP feels it's important to invite donors and to invite the post-secondary education institutions to come together to create these endowment funds. And the way that they work is that we already have four endowment funds established. I should mention one at York University, one at Toronto Metropolitan University, formerly Ryerson. There's one set up at the University of Manitoba and also at Pearson College in Vancouver. So what CFPDP is doing is reaching out through, for example, public service ads generously donated by the Globe and Mail, to ask donors to come forward and donate $100,000 that CFPDP would then add $10,000 on top of that, and then the universities would match that to make a $220,000 endowment fund. Now, those funds would be invested, and the proceeds raised from those investments would fund bursaries and scholarships for perpetuity. And the endowment funds would be named after the donor who makes the generous $100,000 donation. So, certainly these types of funds can make a real difference for people. They can change the career trajectory of a student with a disability who is studying and looking to, add to their educational credentials and add potentially a professional designation, to their qualifications.
So what are the next steps forward for the foundation?
Well, as I mentioned, we do have our next selection board meeting for a seat at the table coming up at the end of October. From there, our committee, our selection board, will select the latest candidates for us to promote actively for corporate board positions. Then from there, we're also continuing to, reach out to people, to potential donors, regarding our endowment funds. And the endowment funds and the seat at the table program kind of go hand in hand, because, the people who are being chosen by the selection board have obviously already reached that board readiness stage of their career, or they already have board experience, leadership experience that they're bringing forward. But we also want to be creating the leaders of tomorrow and helping to, drive forward the dreams of, students with disabilities who are looking to, have a wonderful career in business as the leader, as a change maker. So we'll continue to you know, work the endowment funds program going forward. And then, as I said, our latest candidates chosen by the selection board will be announced soon after the selection board meeting.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us back on the show, Cam.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Bryce Dolan will be telling us about KSDS. So, can you tell me a bit about KSDS?
Yeah, absolutely. KSDS, Assistance Dogs Incorporated, was founded in 1990, been around for 32 years. And since then, we have placed over 600 dogs in 36 different states here in the U.S. Just last year, the organization actually went international with the breeding program. We sent a puppy as a potential assistance dog over to another service dog school or assistance dog school in Ireland. And we have another dog that's earmarked to go to a school in Australia. In return, we will get a puppy from each one of those schools when one becomes available. But what we do here is we breed, raise, and train guide dogs, service dogs, and facility dogs with a mission to give our clients a more physically independent life. And we do that by removing the financial barrier of receiving one of these assistance dogs. We price our dogs north of $25,000. The only cost to our clients to receive these dogs is a $25 application fee and then the time spent on our campus learning how to work with their new canine companion.
So how do you reach out to the disability population to let them know about your work and about the assistance dogs you provide?
Great question. We do anything and everything we can to really kind of spread word about what we do, Cam. Specifically, we go to health fairs, different events where we're exhibitors, have booths, where we can also put on demonstrations of what our dogs can do. We're constantly going not just around the immediate area here in Kansas, but all over the country. We give programs and presentations, whether in person or virtually, about what we do and the resources that we provide for those with disabilities. We do have volunteer puppy raisers in over 20 different states here in the U.S. And they, in fact, some are extremely helpful in getting the word out about KSDS. And from the east to the west coast to the Pacific Northwest to the south, we have volunteers raising our future assistance dogs, and some of those volunteers go out and give presentations, programs, and host booths and tables and things like that as well.
So what are some of the most common areas of assistance the dogs help with?
Absolutely. First of all, service dogs, they're going to be paired with somebody who has more of a physical disability, so think somebody in a wheelchair, whether that be a powered wheelchair or manual wheelchair, or even someone who uses walking canes. Our service dogs are a physical mobility tool. They help people transfer from their bed to their wheelchair. They can help people get undressed or dressed. They can help open and close cabinets or doors, retrieve items out of the fridge, out of those cabinets. They can retrieve dropped items. Let's say somebody in a wheelchair drops their phone or drops some change or their debit card or their credit card. The dogs are able to pick those things up and give them back to the handler if they're not able to get out of their chair and retrieve those items themselves. Specifically, our guide dogs are meant for people with a vision impairment. So more commonly, they're known as seeing eye dogs, but the proper term is guide dog. And they're meant for anybody who has a slight vision impairment to total blindness. And they can do things like transmit to their handler when the texture of the ground changes from cement to grass. If they're about to step off the sidewalk into the street, they can let their handler know that it's a rounded curb or a sharp curb or even a broken curb on the side of the street. They can alert their handler to oncoming traffic, keep them out of harm's way. They can also avoid obstacles and overhanging objects if they're walking down the street. Another thing they can do is they can be told to find the door or find outside or find a chair, and they're able to take their handler to those places.
So, are there ever any challenges in training the dogs themselves?
Great question, and absolutely. Just like people, Cam, all dogs are different, and we have a very stringent health code, or I guess health standard when it comes to the dogs in our program, and they can be cut from our program for a number of reasons. One could be maybe some slight hip dysplasia, or maybe they have some tumors, potential tumors, or things in their eyes that could potentially cause an issue with their eyesight down the road. Those canines, those dogs are automatically cut from our program because we can't pair them with somebody and rely on them to be a mobility tool if they themselves have the chance of having a health issue. So those dogs are cut from our program. Then you get into the behavior of the dogs. Sometimes the temperament of the dogs gets them cut from the program, whether they have really bad separation anxiety and can't stand being away from their handler, if they're hyperactive and are unable to focus and settle down, because that is a big part of their job, whether they're a guide service or a facility dog, is to be able to focus and listen to the commands from the handler.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with KSDS, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, in fact, we just had a client earlier this year who came and received her third dog from KSDS. It is her fourth working dog overall. But when she received her first dog from us at KSDS, it was a service dog. She was bedridden with her disability. For 10 years, she laid in a bed, barely got out. When she got her first service dog, she was able to transfer herself into a wheelchair, be more mobile, get out of her community, be a more productive member of the society. But then as time went on and her physical mobility improved, her eyesight actually started to go. And so once her dog, her service dog, aged out of its working life, she contacted us and said, I need another dog, but I need a guide dog. And so she came, we put her through our program. We matched her with actually a bigger lab because she still needs some bracing, but she also needs a guide dog. And she lives in the suburbs of St. Louis, Missouri. And with her guide dog, she is able to commute to work using public transportation all by herself with her and her dog, go to her office as an addiction counselor, and able to safely get back home to her house in the suburbs using public transportation. And she was not able to do that without a canine companion.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Blood donors are needed now as much as ever. If you would like to help meet the needs of patients across Canada, please consider booking an appointment by calling 1-800-DONATE, visiting blood.ca, or through the Give Blood app. The Windsor Blood Donor Center is located at 3909 Grand Maris Road East. Please note that extra safety precautions have been taken during this time, and only healthy individuals with a scheduled appointment will be allowed to donate blood.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about KSDS from Bryce Dolan, and Christine Payne gave us an update on CFPDP. In this segment of our show, Joe Zeski will be telling us a little bit about his work with the ADA. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with the ADA Center?
Yes, the Northeast ADA Center is located within the Yang Tan Institute of Cornell University. The Northeast ADA is one of 10 centers around the United States that provide training, technical assistance, and research on the Americans with Disabilities Act. And our goal is to promote public knowledge and implementation of the ADA to make a more inclusive community and to ensure that people who have disabilities are a part of that community.
So what are some of the common barriers to acting within the guidelines of the ADA?
There are a few things I would highlight. One would be a lack of knowledge about the law itself and what responsibilities organizations have, whether it's an employer, a business, a state or local government. a lot of times these organizations aren't fully aware of what their responsibilities are. But in terms of specific barriers, I would say that physical access continues to be an issue for people with disabilities in a host of different environments. And again, partly I think that's from a lack of knowledge. Sometimes it's due to a sort of inertia. A business has been open for many years. They should be implementing more of the ADA, but they are not for one reason or another. The other item I would highlight is accommodations in the workplace. A lot of times, employees who have disabilities still face persistent issues around getting reasonable accommodations to ensure that they're able to do their jobs effectively and meet the obligations that their jobs entail. And that continues to be a big issue, and one that we certainly hear a lot about at the Northeast ADA.
So, in your work, how do you reach out to the affected communities to let them know that your education and training and supports are available to them?
We do it in several ways. The first, and probably still most effective, is often word of mouth, at least in terms of trainings and research. People hear about us through organizations with whom we've trained or worked, and they spread the word to other places. In terms of the general public, a lot of it is through our presence on the web, through our website, through social media. We do try to actively reach out to underserved communities. For example, right now, one community that our entire national network is focused on is reaching out to people who speak Spanish as their first language. And so we're reaching out to stakeholders, organizations who are organizations who have a prominent role in the Spanish-speaking community. So we make sure that they're aware of who we are and what we do. And so it's a combination of some proactive steps along with some steps that are more passive in nature.
So in your time with the center, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
A lot of times we hear about success stories along the way. Often we get feedback from people who we've provided technical assistance. In other words, people who we've given information to about their rights or responsibilities, where someone has needed an accommodation on the job. We've told them about what that process should look like, what it should involve. And they contact us back to say what the result was of that outcome. So I was able to get this accommodation. And other times we get feedback from people who sort of become what we call frequent flyers. In other words, people who come back to us repeatedly for information and assistance. And we have different segments of the community that do that. There's a number of what are called independent living centers, which are advocate organizations for people with disabilities who we work with on an ongoing basis because we've helped them with providing information about how accessible improvements should be made in the community. I know one independent living center with whom we worked has made significant progress in several towns in the area in which they serve, including train access and transportation access. So there are many small successes along the way, and a lot of times those stories are highlighted either through our own work that we publish on our website or through the ADA National Network, which is the larger network the Northeast ADA belongs to.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in terms of equal access, what would you say?
I think equal access is something that everyone needs to think about for a lot of reasons. You may or may not have a disability now, but there's a chance that you may acquire one later on. Perhaps you're a business and you think to yourself, well, we've never had someone try to come in here with a wheelchair, but that may be because you have that single step in front of your business and someone who does use a wheelchair can't access it. Or you might say to yourself, well, we've never had someone who's needed a sign language interpreter come to my medical office. And that may be because they've heard or it's been talked about in the deaf community that this particular provider won't provide a sign language interpreter as they should under the law. So improving access for everyone is really everyone's interest, whether you may have a disability, you may know someone with disability, or you may remember that at some point you may get a disability, whether through just simple aging or something else. So accessibility is of interest to everybody.
So do you find that some of the reluctance you alluded to be compliant is because people are hesitant to take that first step and recognize it's in their own interests? As a smart business leader, one should know that a customer with a disability is just as valid as anyone else.
Absolutely. And a customer with disabilities dollar, or wherever you happen to be, whatever your currency is as valuable as anyone's without a disability. And in order to get into that market and to tap into that market, you have to reach out. And so word of mouth, again, is a powerful indicator. If people know that a business is disability friendly, if you will, or they know that a place has a good reputation in terms of being inclusive, that word tends to spread and people know about it and will talk about it with family, friends, and others. So I think it is important and for a business leader to be aware of that.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thanks. My friends, it's an ongoing source of curiosity to me. Disability laws are so under-advertised. I mean, things like the ADA and here in Canada, the Accessible Canada Act, these are great policies. Even things like the UN Charter. But honestly, they can only do the good they're intended to do if people are made aware of them and what they mean. Fact is, a smart business person should know that someone with a disability is going to come through their doors one day and should know how to respond to it. But honestly, it need not necessarily come from a place of, this is the law, it's what I have to do because some book or some doctrine tells me to. Should come from a place of, we're people, human beings, with a right to be counted just as much as anyone else. And honestly, getting to know someone with a disability is usually the fastest way to open that door. You see them as a person with a real-life story, not some statistic that you may or may not encounter in your lifetime. It's from an actual person, their lived experience, that policies should be built. People with disabilities have to be part of the policies being made. Nothing about us without us. It's not just fine words. It's an ideal that says you can't speak for a group unless you have representatives of that group included. You can't just assume what needs to be done so you can pat yourself on the back and say how great you are for doing something for the disability community. It's not something meaningful. It's not something that is well known. It can't be as effective as it's intended. Human decency and that sense of community in us all should be the underlying reason to do right by people with disabilities. Sadly, the truth remains, legal reinforcement can be a way of encouraging, shall we say, the more stubborn members of our population to keep equality in mind. For the fact is, disability equality is preparing for one's own future and respecting one's own past. For disability is in every family and likely in everyone's lifetime in one form or another, whether it's something we recognize or not. So, we can choose to embrace equality or we can choose to say, this is not something I'll have to deal with. An ostrich can always stick its head in the sand. It's not going to make the world go away. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me, you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.